From the floor of a tiny hotel room on Mason Street in San Francisco, California, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Dale LaCroix, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I do make nice games.
This week, we're out west at GDC 2024. We'll be recapping and discussing some of what we've seen and done during our time here at the show. And so if everybody is ready, let's start.
Okay.
Your time starts now.
Yes.
All right. Wednesday.
Wednesday.
It happens to be today. It does happen
Wednesday
to be today.
Now.
Yes. For an hour and a half longer, it is Wednesday.
Oh, gosh. It is that late, isn't it?
Yeah. So we don't have to remember too far back.
Yeah.
So what happened on Wednesday?
Yes. Am I going first again?
Sure.
Okay. Well, so the expo was open today.
Yes.
So anyways, I went to that. And then I went to a pitch with Microsoft for our horror game. And that, I think, went very well, but admittedly, I haven't gone to a lot of pitch meetings. It's kind of interesting, and maybe I'll talk about these more on Friday. I could talk about it now, I guess. I haven't been to pitch meetings before, it's different. I guess when I go, I'm not, like, part of the pitch proper. I'm, like, not even on the slides, because I don't have enough high-profile games to look impressive, I think. But every time I go, people are like, yeah, this is Steven. He's a programmer. He's great. So, that you know, I feel included regardless.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is, like, specifically my role is, like, sometimes, it's kind of rare, but sometimes people will ask me questions about, like, our plans for, like, the tech and stuff that we're using for the game.
Mm.
So I have to answer those. A lot of times I have to answer those on the fly because, like, sometimes it's just, like, stuff we haven't thought about.
Yeah.
Or things we haven't quite researched yet. And so, like, I try to answer those to the best of my ability, but I'm always, when I do it, I always try to be upfront about it and say, like, hey, I don't have all of this experience, but I've done some research and here's what I think, or something like that. And I like to think that it comes across well. Franny said I was doing a good job, so that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
Especially since I think she's been in these pitches, so she knows better than me. Yeah, it's just kind of interesting because, like, basically, you know, I think we should probably do a talk on, like, pitching to publishers or an episode on that.
Yeah. I mean, we've had some episodes where we've had some folks who could give us some proper learning on it. Mm-hmm. But I think you and I now have enough experience that we could probably lay out some stuff.
Yeah, I think we maybe don't have as much experience as a lot of people do in the industry.
Yeah,
but
yeah, we're not experts.
Yeah, but I think we could still provide some kind of insights.
Yeah, one thing I will know,
yeah,
and this is something that you'll probably learn soon,
yeah,
is the best, the pitch that went the best,
yeah,
will be the one you never hear from again.
Mm.
Like, and not as a rule, but, like, that's the kind of thing that happens.
Sure.
Generally, because people, like, I mean, you think of people, particularly people who have money to give,
right,
think of them as kind of cynical.
Yeah.
But the truth is they're all pretty excited about everything.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're putting, I don't think they're faking it, in a sense. But, yeah. And so a pitch going well is a really good sign. It's,
yeah,
not something you should just be like, well, who the hell knows?
Yeah.
But the result doesn't always match up with that.
That definitely I can agree with.
Yeah.
That tracks with my experience.
And that tracks with one of the talks that went today.
Yay.
Cool. Yeah.
Are we segueing into your stuff? Because I don't remember what it
was.
No, I did go to one other talk, actually.
All right.
Let's hear it.
So I went to Black Designer's Dilemma.
Mm-hmm. What is that dilemma?
Actually, it's interesting that the dilemma is not about design. The dilemma was when you're like,
should I be black?
No, it's not. It's not the
knock on it. Yeah.
Sorry.
No. It's more about, like, how when you're in a space that you're, like, you're the only person of color or a black person specifically,
mm-hmm,
represented in a space. How do you deal with such and such problem?
Yeah.
And so, like, honestly, the talk, while it was relevant for me in certain situations back in the day, it is not as relevant to me now at Future Club. I'm not the only black person at Future Club, but there's, like, only two of us.
Yeah.
But also, I think that because, one, we're a co-op, two, there's so many of us who are underrepresented in several different ways already. We don't really have that issue. Like, if we have it, I'd like to think.
Yeah.
And I feel this way. That, like, if we have an issue like that, we talk about it pretty openly.
Huh.
So
that is actually interesting to hear.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my understanding from my readings on the topic.
Sure.
Is that regardless of how supportive your environment is,
yeah,
that does never go away. But I suppose you can't really be bothered to think about it all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that's part of what a lot of these questions, basically the way that the format was, this was a panel.
Yeah.
And there's the host presented a bunch of scenarios and presented their scenarios to the panel, and they would answer it to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these scenarios were really corporate stuff.
Sure.
You're in a situation where someone is wanting to support your ideas, but they keep explaining what you're saying, and you have to deal with some form of microaggression or something.
Yeah.
And so how do you handle that situation? Do you talk to this person? Do you talk to HR? Blah, blah, blah. A lot of the answers were go to a better company that supports you better. And frankly, you have to do that.
Yeah, great advice.
Honestly, it's not great advice, but also, yeah, maybe though, you know?
Yep.
Go to somewhere that's better for you as a person, if you can.
If people have a hard time giving the advice, here's how you cope.
Yeah.
Because that feels like a defeat.
Well, yeah. And it doesn't just feel like a defeat, but it just feels like it's just sad, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How dare you not just cope?
But there's definitely situations where people need that advice, even if it's because
they're stuck in a situation that they can't escape.
Right. I do really empathize with people who are in a position to give advice to not want to give that advice.
Yes.
Because it can be dangerous.
Yeah. So, yeah, but I thought that it was still a good talk.
Yep.
At the very least, it was cathartic.
Yeah.
But I don't know that, like I said, I don't know that I personally, I don't know that it, is as relevant to me. And I think part of also another reason why Future Club, I keep talking to Future Club and specifically with respect to this.
Yep.
But I think part of it is they're just because we're also remote, we don't have a lot of those kinds of interactions.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yeah, it doesn't come
that
up.
That is, and some of that is engendered by physicality.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. That's interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think all of my coworkers are aware that I'm Black, but it's not. I don't know how they can get away with not knowing that. But
yeah,
I think
it's more
so that just we don't have a lot of those interactions in the hall or at the water cooler or whatever.
Right.
So some of those interactions can be awkward microaggressions or something.
A lot of those social situations that have been informed by decades of bias in behavior and instinct.
Yeah.
That's just not how your company is structured.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think honestly, that's probably the major reason why. I think also, if people at Future Club are great, and we try to avoid those kinds of or we try to handle those kinds of conflicts as best as we can, as soon as we can.
Sure,
but I think a lot of it, honestly, is just we're just all remote. Mm-hmm. So that that could be if you have the option to be remote, maybe that's a better solution. Nobody brought that up in the middle of the panel, but I'm coming to that conclusion now.
Yeah. Living in Hope, you'd wonder if a company that builds its culture without the weight of those things.
Yeah.
The sort of things you don't see but happen.
Yeah.
So you don't know. And even with everyone with good intentions.
Right.
If you build your culture without that stuff.
Yeah.
What were to happen if suddenly, for some reason, you all ended up in the same city and rented an office?
Yeah.
Would those things start to bubble up? Or would the culture you built inoculate you a little bit from some of that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I wonder.
All good questions. It'd be nice if we were all in the same city, though.
Yeah.
I like my coworkers a lot.
Yeah.
Outside of that, we went to the expo hall. Me and Reese went to the expo hall. Friends of the show. Reese has been on the show before a few times. And we just got so much swag, y'all.
Steven shows his bag. It's just his loot.
Yes. I got a whole bunch of random stuff. It's great. I got a rubber duck. I got a hat. I got a notebook. I got a spork. Where do you get sporks? Come on. I got a spork. This is great. I got a whole bunch of socks.
Now, listener, you're all laughing at Steven's expense right now,
but
you haven't seen this spork.
It's a cool spork, right?
It's pretty good, yeah. Of course, all the emails we use to register for our press badges, they all get funneled to the same inbox for convenience. And so I saw all your little update of this bag was scanned, your bag was scanned.
Oh, that's hilarious. I try to avoid those, especially because the secret to getting good swag without having to get stuck with all these crap emails is just you gotta be sneaky. You gotta be stealthy. You gotta slip in there, wrap the pin, don't look like you're trying to talk to anybody, and leave. That's the best thing to do.
Yeah.
If you're stuck in line for a little bit, people will notice, and then they'll be like, hey, you want to talk about gaming solutions for the web or whatever? And I'm like, I don't want to hear all that. So,
I mean, Yeah, but
now the purpose of all this lag is so people see your company, your name, and they right. think of you every once in a while.
Right. So really, who got played here?
I did not get played. You know, I don't know what any of this stuff is. I don't even know half of the names.
Yeah, all the people you encounter, will you wear it and show off all your cool swag?
I'm not going to wear
it. You're spreading the word, the good word of whatever it is, B2B solution.
The secret, Mark, is you pick up the swag and then you don't care about the swag and you throw away half of it. It's not a great solution, but it's just, honestly, it feels like a mini game. You're going into the thing. It's great.
Okay.
Zale and Steven are both wearing their Unreal shirts.
True. Yeah.
Actually, the Unreal shirt is cool. I'm going to wear mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a couple of Unreal and Unity shirts from over the years, and they all just are kind of not worth wearing.
Yeah.
But this year's one is nice.
Like, last year's one was all, like, sparkly, and it said Unreal across the chest.
It had the old style Unreal Tournament looking logo, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Which is cool for people who are into that, but that wasn't my jam.
Sure. I don't know. I think it's funny because then it just looks like I am saying I had plastic surgery. These are not real.
Because it's written across your chest. Yeah.
But it's sparkly. Yeah. It's very, like, it's a very feminine shirt. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yes, I am wearing my Unreal shirt.
Yeah.
I went to the expo hall the first time. It is overwhelming and really commercial, and I don't want to talk to anybody because my job is producer on this podcast, and I don't care about your Web3 whatever. I don't really care about the swag because clearly I get the swag anyway because somebody picks me up an Unreal shirt.
Yeah.
But, like, I was amazed by, like, how, like, over the top some of the booths were, because it's not just like, hey, we have a booth, we have a swag, we have people to talk to, you know, like win the whatever at the Discord booth, but like some of these displays are like two stories high and they have like a staircase in them, and this is kind of beyond, like, you know, like I think of the car show as my main like convention center convention reference.
Yeah.
And this is way beyond that.
Right. And they have cars at that show.
And they have cars at true that action. Show. Yeah. Which are very expensive things.
Yeah. Well, you've been to the Adobe Max show floor, but that can be a little bit over the top in a sense, but I don't think they have two-story booths.
No.
I will say that there's some utility there. A lot of those two-story booths have meeting spaces. So, like, that's where they hold their meetings, is at their booth.
Yeah, a lot of the booths actually have meeting space.
In fact, there's a lot that happens at GDC that has been invented by its participants, because the GDC, everyone who goes to GDC remarks as to how poorly run it is, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And when I say poorly run, poorly designed is the better word.
Sure.
Like, they have spaces for you to hold meetings. They have those sort of soundproof-ish areas for companies to do deals, but it's all very underexplained. The systems for signing up are very poorly made. It sort of works, and then it's just fine.
Yeah.
And so a lot of these companies will then just solve the problem themselves.
Yeah.
And they just build a second floor to their booth with three rooms, and that's where they have their meetings. And then that works out way better for them, because they don't have to tell people, go to room 602 at the far end of the expo hall. Don't get lost through all of the, you know, what this or that. They just say, like, come to our booth. We have a sign that's 20 feet tall.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
that was interesting. And then I was like, I'm getting out of here. And I did.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Okay. I went to, let's go with three talks today. The first one I thought was going to be something different, but it was canceled. And its place was a talk called So You've Been Canceled, which was very confusing for me.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Anyway, it turned out it was very interesting. It was put on by Respec, not Respect, but like when you get all your spec points back and you can spend it on your skill tree again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was founded by a person who used to be the hotline director at a game harassment hotline. So I thought that was interesting. And it was really kind of working with and like this looked at the not like working with the people who were the abusers or the people who had caused harm in a relationship, whether that's an online game or an in the workplace in like a gaming industry thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was really interesting because kind of going off your Black and gaming dilemma, like this was really, you know, the truth and reconciliation of that, of like really for those people to understand what they did to provide a social group for them. And they meet monthly, so it's not really that often.
Yeah.
But like I would, you know, having been to neither of these groups,
right,
kind of think it's analogous to Alcoholics Anonymous, where you, you know, like you speak and you be vulnerable at,
yeah,
say what happened to you. And like the most interesting thing that like they kind of talked about was like how these people over time, they come to the first meeting and they're like, oh, I went to GDC, I went to a party, and then all these, you know, ridiculous articles written about me, and then mm-hmm. nobody wanted to talk to me, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it would go from that and like, you know, next month to be, oh, I went to a GDC, I went to a party, and, you know, I might have like stepped up to the line. And like,
sure,
for them to be able to like process what they did and why it was wrong and how it harmed the other person.
Yeah, that's really good, because like I think a lot of times with these kinds of situations, people will start doubling down, not recognizing what they did, and having a place where they can feel like other people can recognize that like a bunch of stuff happened to them and it sucks for them, but also the things that I did were not right, and I, yeah, you know, I'm having a hard time struggling to understand that, but I'm coming to terms with that. Mm-hmm. That's cool. That, yeah, like, there's a space for that.
And they very much called out, like,
yeah,
barriers, and one of them was defensiveness.
But yeah.
And then, like, kind of this sense of confusion, if nobody's called me out on this before,
right,
why I'm all of a sudden, like, it's super wrong, you, yeah, know?
Sure.
And, like, the social isolation that comes with that, because people will, like, obviously, like, I'm going to call the person who's been hurt by you. Mm-hmm. Will, like, you know, they're usually your friends.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, not coming from a place of not understanding and not getting it. So, like, suddenly, you know, like, you're cut off from this friend, you're cut off from this group of friends, you're fired from your job. People don't want to associate you with you because that looks like you're associating with somebody who's bad or evil, which, yeah, is not true. It's just comes from a point of not understanding. So I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be like, and we'll put this organization's link in the show notes should you have actually been canceled. But like, it didn't really address like kind of the, I mean, it addressed the bigger picture and the fact that like, you know, like with the analogy, you know, like a few bad apples ruin the bunch. And so you throw out the bad apples, but that's not really it is. What it is, if the problem is all the apples were, you know, grown in the same kind of poison soil.
Yeah.
It's the culture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And so they acknowledge that, but like, that's not the purpose of their organization.
Right. And that's not the purpose of the talk.
Yeah. And like, it kind of got me thinking about stuff about like, from their perspective, it feels all of a sudden like this thing. And if I had done this thing that was bad, like, what's all the other stuff that I got? That was bad that,
sure,
I didn't get called out on.
Yeah.
And then it made me think about your Black dilemma and like what the best solution is there. And, you know, it's not always to get another job, but one of the things is potentially to have an advocate for you who can call out the people without you having to call out everybody, because that's really, that will take all your forks away, all your sporks away. Sorry, people use the spoon analogy.
Dale likes using forks because it's a different word, I think.
Yeah, it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about like the title of the talk is So You've Been Canceled, but yes, presumably it wouldn't, if for no other reason than shame, it was unlikely that the audience for that talk was full of canceled people. So
I would say like it was a 9 a.m. talk, so like it was not well attended.
Okay.
And then it was also in the room for my talk that actually had been canceled.
Right. So you were there for by happenstance.
I was there by happenstance, but I'm sure there were other people in the room for that. You know, maybe it would be helpful if you actually had been canceled, but you're like, oh, this is a resource I could use. So I don't really know who the audience
Yeah.
I mean, it might
what be, best?
They might be curious about, for lack of a better term, rehabilitation. I don't know if that's the right term. Yeah.
It's not a punishment. It's a, you know, working through things,
yeah.
Taking care of ourselves, wanting to change, understanding.
Yeah.
That, or believing that change would matter, uh-huh. And like having that connection and support to actually make that change.
Yeah.
And make that change lasting. The one
yeah.
thing that they did say is, change that's done overnight can be undone overnight. So they right. really emphasized how long of a process this can
yeah.
be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I imagine there are a lot of people who are curious about that process.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of the reason I asked.
Yeah.
Is because it was on my list of like, might be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it kind of just illustrates how thankless that kind of work is.
Yeah.
Because I think it's, and honestly, I don't have a problem saying that the concerns of the canceled rank low in the pantheon of restorative justice actions
yeah.
that need to occur
sure.
in those scenarios.
Yeah.
That said, the fact that there are people there to address the concerns from that direction, mm-hmm. and kind of to the exclusion of everything else, to provide a safe space and to provide that path for people.
Mm-hmm.
To keep them from going down a reactionary path.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that there's a lot of people who would be like, let them go down the reactionary path, right?
Oh.
And again, you know, generally when that happens, the victims not only have greater concern, they generally outnumber the victimizer. So like, where is the resources best spent, right?
Yeah.
All that said, it does illustrate that if someone is dedicated to providing that path and for being of service to these people who kind of need to do the work and they need work done, right?
Yeah.
They're not maybe at first ready. They may be mandated to participate initially, right? By an employer or something. They may not be the one who took the first step. And so
yeah.
But yeah, just how thankless that work is.
Yeah.
And it kind of like, oh yeah, that's, you know, the world needs, you know, garbage collectors.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
Which that is maybe not a fair analogy, but it's kind of what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
you know, that you need people to do unglamorous work.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that, you know, like, you know, what I found was really helpful in understanding the organization is that this came out of not somebody who had been rehabilitated or had been canceled and then worked through that and was like, and I, you know, and reputation.com helped me get my reputation back. No, it came from, you know, kind of a victim's advocacy group seeing a real need for this.
Okay, interesting.
Then I went to a couple mixers. They were okay. And then lastly, I went to Take My Money. Getting money is what I wrote in my thing, but that's more like a venture capitalist kind of guy about how like pitching the game.
Yeah.
So what kind of did a, you know, informal survey of like with publishers, you know, if, you know, from that first contact, if you submit that game on that web forum or if you submit that game via email to somebody, how likely does it get through that funnel to the final product of being a signed game that they actually publish?
Yeah.
You want to take any guesses?
No. 3%.
No.
Dang.
It's about 0.2%.
Okay, I was going.
I mean,
you're off by an order of magnitude, but you know, whatever. Like, it's a nice to have like a metric in your mind
yeah.
when you're pitching games. If I pitch it, you know, just on the web, how likely am I to get a follow-up if it's like a relatively good match? And the answer is 25% of those get a callback.
Mm.
And then so on down the line to due diligence, to signed. And this is kind of where I was mentioning, it kind of makes sense that like your best pitches are the ones you never hear from again. It's sure. because they're enthusiastic about the deal, but they're not doing that due diligence of like, how marketable is this? How much do I trust this team to be able to produce the product that they're promising? And asking those kind of harder questions, which can make it feel worse.
Did you get any information about like where that decision making comes from? Because one of the things I've definitely found in pitching and hearing about other people's business experiences is that your job is to see it from their perspective, but it's not your job to do their job for them. So you want to let them know everything they need to know to do their analysis, but also you really have no control over influencing those that part of their decision making. Like, that's just up to them, and that's why you can't really know how it's going to go. You could get them excited about a concept. You can prove to them you're a good team and that you're budgeted well, but like, there are 10 other variables that they are concerned about that it's not your job to even care about.
They're thinking about what's the market, how many other puzzle platformers are there now, and like, basically they said the market is saturated for that, so like, nobody's investing in that.
It might just be like a release date sort of thing, like your timeline, your game comes out in a reasonable timeline, you know, it takes a year or whatever, but it's just not, they already have a bunch of games lined up for that particular time.
Or like, we have this many producers, which means we want to ship 3 games, we have this much budget, which means the 3 games budgets need to add up to our total budget, and yours is just off enough because we don't have a fourth producer. Like, it could really just be that.
It might have nothing to do with your pitch.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it might have nothing to do with pitch. It might have something to do with the market. It might have something to do with, like, what is this publisher's portfolio, like, upcoming portfolio, pipeline looking like. Kind of what he talked about was, like, environment now where money is a little bit tighter, where everybody thinks like the game industry is like, oh my gosh, it's on fire, which it's not. It's just a little bit tougher than it used to be. He thinks that investors are really, and publishers are really looking for more evidence that this game is most likely going to be a success.
Yeah.
So like, building up that evidence early is the best. And then like, his suggestion for like, after pitching, is to ask, you know, if the usually the answer is, yeah, this looks good, but like, you know, it looks, come back later, and like, we're not quite ready to invest yet. Steven's nodding like, maybe that's something he's heard before.
Yeah.
Is to like, very directly ask, you know, like, what would you like to see?
Yeah.
In order for this, you know, this to be, what is that evidence that you're looking for? That's basically what I got from that. It was a lot. It was things that are not in my wheelhouse. So it was a lot of information for me to take in that I'm guessing is, you know, sometimes kind of basic for somebody who actually does this stuff. And that's all I did today.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm gonna turn.
All right. So I went to a local community roundtable.
Okay.
So this was for folks who are leaders in their local development communities. So that was relevant to me. And I was really hoping to learn a little bit more about growing a game dev community at the stage that we are at in the Twin Cities, which is we're putting together this nonprofit company, a 501c3. We're looking to do some fundraising through grants, through sponsorships, so we can do more events and things like that. And I hinted at that in past episodes. I'll talk more about it going forward. And there were one or two other people who were at a similar inflection point, but no one who showed up to this roundtable was past that. So there wasn't a lot for me to learn from that group. But one of the things about the roundtables at GDC is it is kind of like a coin flip. You either go with a lot of questions, and then the people in, because it is just people talking to each other. There's a facilitator, but it's designed for people to share knowledge with each other. That's what this format is.
Mm-hmm.
It's a coin flip. You either go with a lot of questions that you can hear from other people, or rather you sit and just absorb what other people are telling or are saying, which is usually how I do these things. And then the other side of that coin is you're the one with some answers.
Yeah.
And I ended up being someone with some answers, and it wasn't what I was there for.
Sure.
But I was happy to do it, and also hear from other people who, forming communities in New York or Connecticut, or in rural areas, and just their unique problems. And I was talking about like, well, what happens, you know, do you do monthly events, do you do weekly events? And so one of the things that was actually felt, obvious to me, because we do this in the Twin Cities, but it was sort of kind of eye-opening for a lot of other people, is like, yeah, there's that mix between like, if you do monthly events, then if someone misses it, then they're like, they miss it for a whole month, and then they're kind of out of the loop.
Yeah.
But if it's weekly events, then people will choose to miss it because the next one's coming around so soon.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a paradox happening there, and like, you know, there's no really a right answer to it. But you know, we do 6 monthly events in our local community. And one of the reasons why that works for us is because each event is very different and they draw different audiences, and there's crossover. But like, if you miss one, it's not coming around for another month.
Right.
But there's still something next week.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that we engineered it that way, but that's been successful for us as a smaller community. And so I was happy to relay that solution to people who never considered anything like that. Mm. People are like, oh, we're a community. We do playtests. That's our thing.
Yeah.
And like, I'd be like, oh, we do talks. And like, oh, we just do ice cream socials. Like, that's our thing. And it was actually kind of interesting to hear people feel like they found a thing. And that was what their thing is.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't the way we did it. And I don't think that was some wisdom. I think we just lucked into not getting trapped in that thought.
Sure.
Because one of the things that I think I will give us credit for is having that diversity of events is important to our community because it brings out different types of people. And that's been always a goal of mine, is that we don't just calcify into the same, 25 friends every week for 10 years, which is a real danger when you do community building.
Right.
And so I'm just recounting all of this because that was kind of my experience at this roundtable, sharing my experience. And I hope it was valuable to some folks.
Yeah.
But that's what happens at this roundtable. Sometimes you get people who know a little bit like me and not the experts you came to hopefully learn from.
Yeah.
But it was good. Then I waited in line for an hour for the Mario Wonder talk. It was just fun. I didn't have a lot of actionable stuff. Although, what's interesting about the Nintendo talks at GDC is, one, they're very popular.
Mm-hmm.
People show up regardless of what their background is because Nintendo, people love Nintendo.
Right.
That's why I was there.
Yeah.
But weirdly, I think indie developers have the most to learn actually from these Nintendo talks.
Oh.
Because Nintendo is an indie developer with just all the money in the world.
I guess I can kind of see where you're coming from.
Not just because they make 2D games from time to time.
No.
But Tears of the Kingdom is like, it's amazing how little animation is in that game.
Yeah.
Like, really, when you break it down.
Hmm.
Despite it being this expensive AAA experience. Like, when you compare it to something like a Horizon Zero Dawn or the games that, like, really try to get your attention with the sort of fidelity and detail, not just in the graphics, but in the effort. And we have tons of cutscenes. We have lots of custom animations. We have all these great blend shapes.
Right. None of that.
Nintendo's like, whatever, we're just making games over here.
Yeah.
And so it always feels like you're just an indie developer with all the money in the world.
They're successful.
Yeah. And it's not like they spent, sometimes their games do less, but they don't spend less on those games.
Yeah.
So anyway, this was the framing of the talk was about like reinventing a 2D experience.
Sure.
And there are two things I'll say. One that was really fascinating was the whole notion of the Wonder Flower in Mario Wonder came about from this idea of like secrets and hidden items and like going left at the beginning of a level and all those little tricks and stuff. They become part of the language of platformers.
Yeah.
And Mario helped define that, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things the director was saying was, we don't like that's been normalized.
Oh.
Like, we would rather people play and then find, and then just, like, discover new secret things. It had this sort of invented new language for it. And so the Wonder Flower was that solution to that problem.
Okay.
Which isn't to say, and they were clear about this, isn't to say it's the only solution to that kind of problem. Right. But it was interesting because I hadn't heard it framed that way, but it's interesting that their motivation, because to a player, it's like, oh, so it's just Mario with minigames.
Yeah.
It is kind of what it feels like.
Mm.
But when you think of it from that perspective, and if you have 100% of the game and really like, sort of got really deep on it when it came out, the way I did. The description of Mario with minigames feels accurate to what you saw, but not what you felt as you played it.
Yeah.
And so hearing them talk about their motivation for like that's the reason they did that.
Yeah.
And the truth is, there's not a lot of there's like hidden blocks and stuff, but like that kind of play of Mario, I just felt like I was waltzing through that game. Even though I was intent on doing everything, it didn't have the same motivations I do where I'm like looking at every corner.
Yeah.
I trusted the game a little bit more than I usually do.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a direct success of that that intent, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
The second thing was I have this pet theory about Mario Wonder, which is that it was designed, and I talked about this on the show a while back, that there's so much music theme stuff in the game that my pet theory is that it started out as Super Mario Brothers medley.
Yeah.
And that they discovered the Wonder Flower mechanic and then it became another game.
Sure.
Because there's still so much left over, but it doesn't feel very, that there's a lot, there feels like there's a lot of music stuff in it, but it doesn't feel very musical themed.
Yeah.
That's my pet theory.
Yeah.
I got no evidence at this talk.
Okay.
And I was, I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, you know, they didn't disprove anything.
Yeah.
You know, but I was really, I was kind of half expecting to get a little hint that I was onto something, but I didn't, which probably means that it was just my pet theory and not a real thing.
You can keep your tinfoil hat on.
You know, one day I'll, you know, one day I'll get a super press badge and I'll be able to interview one of these folks. And yes. Find out for sure. Yeah. I don't know. I think that's what it takes, right?
Probably.
Yeah.
Future Mark here, jumping in. I did take a lot of notes for this talk, and I kind of wanted to, there's a couple things I didn't talk about. I kind of want to. There's been some press coverage of this presentation, and I figured that would kind of cover all the headline things that people would be interested in seeing, so I didn't really want to get into it. But they missed a couple things, or I didn't see a lot of discussion of it, and I thought I'd relay it to you because I was really fascinated. So indulge me as I stretch out the length of this episode a bit. But one of the really fun things about this was, similar to what we talked about in the last episode, Dale and I went to a talk on a board game where they invited everyone in the studio to help contribute concepts. And then Nintendo did the exact same thing for the Wonderflower effects. They showed a couple prototypes in the talk that were really fascinating. But also they really just said anybody submit an idea. They didn't close it off to senior designers or anything like that. So it really validated what we talked about in the last episode about the idea that like creativity is not exclusive to the people who are professionally employed to be creative, right? And that philosophy, it's nice to see at a big company like Nintendo. But the real reason I wanted to punch in here and talk more about this talk was it was something that really resonated with me a lot. And I kind of forgot about it when we did the recording in San Francisco, which was this concept of a kind world. That's the phrase. And it was this idea of incorporating online play in Mario Wonder. So in the online modes, other players can, they're only empowered to do things that can help you. And you as a player engaging with the online mechanics can only do things that help other players. You can't even really do anything that helps you. And that's what's interesting about it is, it really validates what I've talked about on the show a couple of times. My feeling about toxic environments in video games and how that is really more of a design problem than a moderation problem. And I think Nintendo understands that. I think there's also a little bit of that efficiency that we talked about earlier, where Nintendo wanted to make an online system they could just let run without having to moderate. And so that's why the engagement mechanics are pretty limited. And that's, you know, valid reason to do things. Because if your moderation space is so huge, then it is really ethically on you to, you know, hire a lot of moderators. And I think most innovation in game moderation tends to be about how can we make moderation less labor intensive? And I think that's the wrong angle to come at it at. And I think we talk about that later in this very episode. If not, forgive me, but I think you get the gist. But this idea of a kind world that really, really struck me as a validating some feelings that I have about game design and how when you encourage players to behave in a certain way through the mechanics, that is part of the message. And we've talked a lot about how Mario is a game series that is hardly about anything. And I think that's generally true. But that idea of using these mechanics to encourage selfless behavior, because you have to do things for other players and there's no reciprocation. And the game rewards you in a sense of by creating an environment where that is something you want to do, rather than reward you mechanically by giving you points or by giving you a power up or by putting you in the lead or by playing to other baser instincts. And I think that's a very elegant and very sophisticated game design, despite the fact that it's mechanically very simple. So that I just wanted to punch in and talk about that because I looked at my notes again and I'm like, oh, that's the one thing that really struck me about that talk. So, all right. Thanks for the indulgence and back to your regularly scheduled programming.
There was also a Zelda talk this morning.
Oh,
but I don't know if it was on the schedule or something, but like one of the first questions they asked in the Mario talk was who was at the Zelda talk this morning? And I was like, Zelda talk this morning.
Oh.
And then half the room raised their hand.
Whoa.
And then they go, oh, the Zelda team would be really happy to hear that. And then all the Zelda team started clapping and they're all sitting right next to me.
Oh,
that's funny. I was like, oh, it's the friggin' Zelda team. I'm sorry. So that's fun. So hopefully both of those talks end up on the GDC YouTube soon enough.
Yeah.
Hey folks, fancy seeing you here again. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's coming up next week to tease you about part three of our GDC special. We have two long-form interviews, one with the operations director of Midwest Games. We really get into the details on that new publisher based here in the Midwest, and also some actionable information for indie devs looking to pitch to developers like Midwest and others. So that's coming up next week. Also in that same episode, Steven and I talk with a producer of the Carbon Engine. This is a sort of a bundle of emulators, it's been described as, produced by Limited Run. They are a publisher that makes physical copies of digital indie games, and they're in the business now of digging into the past, finding old classic games, and then republishing those on modern systems using this tool of theirs, which is, again, a pile of emulators, but also some interesting stuff along the way. And that's interesting because we talk about not just that process, but also about learning from games from the past. So that's really, really cool stuff. So stay tuned for both of those next week. But that's not all of our GDC coverage. On our Patreon, that's patreon.com/nicegamesclub, we have all the stuff that we cut from this episode, which is actually quite a lot. Steven has this great story about how he accidentally ended up at a press event, which is really, really cool. Also, I talk about a session on these traversal systems in Spider-Man 2. I also recount a studio funding roundtable that I would describe as disappointing, and you can hear my thoughts on that on the Patreon. Also, not enough room for a classic postmortem recap for the game Karateka, which I went to. My thoughts on that on the Patreon as well. Dale and I attended the IGDA general meeting, where we talk a little bit about our efforts to align our local community with the international organization, the difficulties we've had there, and then our recap of the IGDA's yearly presentation. So that is on the Patreon. Last thing in this list, Dale went to a talk on playtesting, which is a perennial topic here on the show, and really interesting session from Shell Games, and Dale talks about their process for I Expect You to Die 3, and that, again, with all the other stuff that we got cut from this episode, all of that is on our Patreon exclusively, patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Sign up at any level, you get access to all of that and a whole lot more from the history of the show. So check that out, again, patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
Okay, we're like up to Thursday now?
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
It's Thursday.
I mean, it's Friday, but we're going to talk about Thursday and Friday.
Yes.
It's Thursday.
I think this is the part of the week, Thursday, in fact, where things started to get a little bit, we're dragging our feet a little bit.
Yeah.
You're feeling the weight of the conference.
It's, yeah. Been here for 3 days already.
Struggling through the rest of it.
Still got two more. Yeah. It's it gets intense.
So I was supposed to go first this time? Is that it?
That is the plan.
Okay, so I had a couple of meetings that I won't detail because they're not that interesting to our audience. But I was trying to get meetings for a couple of different things here. One relating to the our local community's new nonprofit that we're putting together.
Yeah.
That I've talked about briefly in previous episodes.
Uh-huh.
Trying to talk to some people about support for that. And I got some contacts and some meetings with that. Trying to get some meetings about some work that I'm doing, but I'm not specifically here pitching anything this year.
Yeah.
So a lot of my meetings like didn't matter if they happened or not, frankly. But I had two on Thursday, back to back, in the park that were fantastic.
Nice.
They went really, really well. I was really pleased. And so that's the summary of that. But yeah, definitely, you know, we're here for the show mainly. I am. Steven, you got a lot done with Future Club.
Yes.
And we'll hear more about that, I suspect.
Yes, yes.
But this year in particular, I was like, what am I doing here? And so that was nice to like, okay, I feel like I'm actually doing something here for my own self, right?
Yeah.
Getting stuff for the show is as its own kind of value.
Yeah.
But it was nice to know that like there isn't just that one reason.
That's actually really interesting because like I felt that way too when I was on Monday anyways. Because like, I don't know, I think I've talked about this on the show before, but I don't really like going to talks because they're just lectures.
Uh-huh.
And I already go to school.
Right.
So I don't
and you're famously not a great student.
Not. No, very famously not a great student. So, So I don't particularly enjoy going to lectures. And so, like, sometimes when I come to GDC, I do enjoy seeking out content for the show.
Yeah.
Well, at least until, like, day three, then I'm tired. I don't want to be here anymore. But I do enjoy that aspect of it. But outside of Nice Games Club stuff, I oftentimes feel directionless when I'm at GDC.
Yeah.
Because I don't necessarily want to. There are some talks that could be interesting to go to, but I don't feel very driven to go to them.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I don't really like meeting a ton of new people like GDC makes you do. And so, like, I find that to be, I find GDC to be exhausting a lot of the time.
Right.
Because of that reason. But then Future Club stuff started happening, and then I felt a little more driven because, like, I was like, I got to go to these things.
Yeah.
I got to represent the, represent the company, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I felt more purposeful.
Yeah.
Which was cool.
Well, it speaks to your motivations. Like, the first time you go to GDC, you go kind of because people go.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah.
And then if you make it a habit, it's either like you see your, you know, game dev friends that you don't get to see that much. There's a social aspect to it. Mm-hmm. There's like, but there's a transition point where it is definitely like you need some purpose.
Yeah.
Right. And the show gives us purpose and that's nice. But at the same time, there are big stretches of the week where like we have time to do other things.
Yeah.
And if we're not filling that with other purpose, then, you know, you think back to what you paid on the plane ticket.
Right.
You're like, we have to, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So that was good for me on Thursday. And then I went to a talk about Foley for Spider-Man 2. It was really interesting.
Yeah.
And Dale was with me. And I sat next to Dale. And I want to hear Dale talk about it.
Oh, we went to Titan Foley. Foley is making sounds for... Okay, you describe it.
Okay,
It's adding in the sounds for footsteps and for punches and for fabric rustling as you walk and for turning doorknobs and door creaking and all that stuff. Mm. And it, you know, it's traditionally associated with movies and radio where they would do it live on the air.
Yeah.
But usually it's recorded on a entirely separate soundtrack. And in a studio where, you know, you have somebody with a pair of shoes and they walk on some boards and then they walk on some concrete and then they walk on something that simulates walking on grass.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've never seen like a Foley stage, it's just this little mini universe of surfaces, props, and toys, mm-hmm. and little squares of different types of cobblestone
and materials, and yep.
buckets full of things.
Did they have some of that there?
No.
Aww.
We saw some video.
Yeah, it is really fun. They have a big tub where you like splash through because in Spider-Man, apparently you go in the sewers, so yuck.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was really interesting. The thing that I didn't quite... Okay, here's my lesson learned. Okay, so Spider-Man is a giant open world game set in a city.
Yes.
So with a bunch of NPCs.
Right.
That you would find in the city. So for each one of those, they would do, you know, they identified like six different types of shoes. So there'd be like sneakers and like dress shoes and like boots and like heavy boots and like, you know, you're not barefoot. I don't think anybody's barefoot in that. But anyway.
Yeah.
So you got seven types of shoes. Then they can walk on concrete and grass and wooden floors and metal, you know, like the
grates.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
Dale's making the motion of when the little elevators that open up on the sidewalk.
Oh,
the little door panels that flip out.
Yeah,
that
are your metal grating. Your coal chute, the little thing that goes to the basement. So
yeah.
You can put all your stuff directly in that.
Uh huh.
All of those different services. So now you're going like seven shoe types times this many things. And then you like add in, because it's a fighting game, like a bunch of different body thumps on all of those things.
Right. Yeah.
So you end up recording a lot. Oh, and then like things with like you add grit to it by adding sand on top of your little piece of cement or whatever.
Oh.
So you end up with just it's multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. So, in conclusion, you got a game. You should put everybody in the same type of clothes. They should all wear the same type of shoes.
Yep.
And there should only be one surface, so you're all running around on dirt.
I mean, actually...
That's how to save on your Foley budget.
Yes.
Well, they talked a lot about optimizing for like human perception.
Yeah.
Okay. They're like, okay, we're going to do all these types of things. But, you know, these two different types of shoes sound the same on tile. So we're going to just use the same sound for those and whatever. But like identifying those efficiencies is itself a difficult task.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of time.
Right.
And so sometimes you just record the extra things rather than spend a lot of time focusing on how to perfectly optimize it.
Yeah.
And also there's like opportunities for doing things procedurally. So by changing pitch or volume or quality of audio, which is pretty common. And actually, it's amazing how effective just changing the volume of something is.
Yeah.
You'd think that there's like the timbre of a piece of audio matters so much. And it does. And I know I'm speaking from experience, but sometimes just the volume does actually change a lot more than you think. Let's get away with a lot.
It does.
But they talk about, they use an example of that Dale was citing earlier about the going through water and just like how, depending on how deep in the water you go, the sort of sloshing in this loop, and it's raising volume depending on how fast you're moving. But they also need the footsteps in the water, the sort of like, you know, the kind of sound of every step as you go through.
Yeah.
And mixing all that together was interesting. They played some examples of like each layer of that and how it was all generated procedurally. But then it turns out they had very few other procedural audio in the game. And you think of Spider-Man 2 as something that is like very polished, has lots of everything, right?
Yeah.
And they're clearly doing all the modern techniques for this big open world thing.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's like, no, just 30,000 sounds. Like, it kind of makes you realize like, oh yeah, you know, that sometimes is just the best way to do it is to brute force some of it, you know, efficiencies where you can, but they could have like probably knocked out 10, you know, 5 or 10,000 of those by like building systems to generate or whatever.
Yeah.
But like that would have taken more time probably.
Right.
And so, and that wouldn't necessarily be the wrong approach, but it's just different, right? Someone from, I think from Naughty Dog asked a question about like systems that would help them make things more efficient.
Yeah.
And they were just like, nah. And it's like, oh, right. Cause you would think to do that, but like, you know, you just got to spend your labor budget on this certain things and decisions early.
I also imagine the Foley experts aren't particularly interested in developing those systems.
Oh, they are extremely interested in developing systems because they're the ones who have to make the 30,000 sounds.
Well, and, sure.
And in this case, it was the team from PlayStation that was working with Insomniac.
Yeah.
And so they all, a lot of them had background in film.
Okay.
And so they talked a little bit about their learnings about moving from film to games. And that was really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was just like, we've done enough footsteps. You need 20 more.
All right, fair enough.
You know, but also it was the Foley artist who was one of the speakers.
Yeah.
She was talking about how like her experience was really just being on a stage punching watermelons, right? That's like that's kind of like her bread and butter workday.
Yeah.
And but then just to hear her talk a lot about her not just learning how game audio is processed in games, but then hearing her talk in the language of that about how that works, and you could really tell that she developed a proficiency in implementation, even though she wasn't the one doing it.
Yeah.
And how closely she worked. So just like, it seemed like a really good team, the three people who were on that panel.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a very good panel. And like the thing that the other example I took away with the thing was, apparently you need a hunter and something who is sharpening a knife. So it's a hit and then it's the rub and
go
down.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like if you were doing it in
like to pick
film, you would do it, you know, like if it shows it, you know, if she does it like 8 times, you would do hit swoosh 8 times. But here, because you might be like standing by her for who knows how long, they recorded the 5 hits and 5 swooshes and then would interchange them
randomly. Sure.
So it didn't seem like they were all the same hit or all the same swoosh.
Yeah. And they talked a little bit about how like trying to find the right amount of sounds to provide that level of immersion so you wouldn't notice the repeats, but how that's essentially an art rather than a science.
Yeah.
And you have to balance that with literally how much time do you have to produce these things an NPC is going to do that only a player who is wasting their time is going to hear.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, how do you really need to service the immersion of someone who's going to stand by someone in Spider-Man Times Square eating a hot dog for 30 minutes? Like the same motions over and over? Like you already broke an immersion, but like, you know, you don't want to have to hear the same chewing sound twice.
Right.
So balancing that is really challenging.
That's something.
Before we move on from this one, because it's just so interesting. Like, it's just, you know, when you hearing people talk about their specialty is, I love that. And you really can take away, like, even if it's not direct, actionable things for your own work, just knowing how people work and like,
the baseline understanding of like when they say, you know, like when they say it's going to take this long, why it will take that long.
Yeah.
And when we, like, you know, your animators are sending them assets the last minute and why they get so mad.
So the two funny things that I got away from this, one is that Foley as a word, I don't think a lot of people are familiar with it as the, you know, the footsteps and dragging chains across the ground.
Yeah.
But it's capitalized because it's named after a guy.
Oh.
Interesting. And they just didn't come up with a name for that type of work.
Oh.
And they just named it after the guy who came up with it.
Marcus Foley.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And then the other thing, I wrote this down as a quote because it was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Our salary budget was on this project was pretty good. people who've seen behind the scenes of like action movie Foley will know that you crack a bunch of celery.
Yeah.
And that's a really good proxy for like bone breaks and punches and stuff like that. And so just, of course, in Spider-Man, there's also, of course, the salary budget was good.
Yeah. Well, I went to one talk. I had intended to go to a couple of different talks, a few different talks, because a couple of my coworkers were in talks. ABB, who is our narrative designer at Future Club, she did a talk at One Reason to Be, and she also did...
Why don't you explain to listeners what One Reason to Be is?
Somebody else who went to the talk, maybe, could.
Oh, well, One Reason to Be is the talk that happens every year.
Yeah.
It was created by Brenda Romero and Lee Alexander.
Yes.
Two women designers, I don't know, 15 years ago or something?
Yeah.
It's a long time ago.
A while ago.
Folks who are of my class of game designer would know it as a thing that Rami Ismail hosted for a long time. He took it over from them.
Yeah.
But the phrase One Reason to Be is essentially it's a panel of women designers talking about like the reason they're making games.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it can be very demoralizing and yes. Like, what's the reason? Why are you sticking with it? And so,
dang, I should have went to that actually for sure. And then anyway,
it is often a highlight of the show each year.
Yeah.
I didn't go this year either, so I can't speak to how it went, but it's great that it's a tradition that continues. And there's someone new running it this year. So that it continues.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Cool. Well, Amy had a talk there, and she said it went really well.
Yeah.
Received it very well. I was at a pitch meeting, like right up until it was going to start, so I wasn't able to go.
Yeah. But the official excuse.
Yes.
You hear that, Steven's coworkers?
Oh, gosh. I told Amy, I let her know I felt bad, though, when I wasn't able to go.
I'm really curious. I should watch that later, but I'm curious, let's have her on the show or something.
Yeah. I did a pitch meeting. It was with Trevor Noah's production company. I just didn't know that he had a production company.
When you have enough money.
Like, yeah, I guess. You start. Do with. Whatever. And so we did that. That was a thing. It wasn't that exciting, but you know, we did the thing.
Sure.
Trevor Noah wasn't there. Shocker. and then I missed another one of Amy's talks. I think that you went to it though, Dale.
I went to this one.
Yeah. Can you describe it? Because I want to hear about it.
She talked about starting a story you can finish.
Yeah.
And what I learned was this incredibly demoralizing thing, because this is my thing, which is ideas are easy. It was one on the thing. I was like, oh no. And then number two on our lines was scope and structure are not universal. So it was a shorter talk. So
yeah, it was 30
minutes. And it was, you know, something that I don't think about because I don't think about story structure that much.
Sure.
So like I didn't take out as much from it.
Yeah.
But I guess my main takeaway from it is, you know, really thinking about what do you actually do in this thing. And, you know, she said one of her visual novel called Heaven Will Be Mine. And the core mechanic is choosing how you fall in love, not if you fall in love or necessarily who you fall in love with.
Yeah.
And then thinking about how that can be reinforced by the form if it's an action game, you have to move things fast to go with the action. If it's slower, how you, the UX, the fonts, is it going to be cutscenes? Is it going to be dialogue boxes?
Yeah.
Is it going to be summaries at the bottom of the screen? Mm-hmm. So that's what I got out of it.
Cool. Well, thank you, Dale. Yeah.
So that's what Steven should have been doing.
Yes. I was at another pitch meeting at the same time. Even better excuse. it was with I Am 8-Bit. Pitched our horror game again. Cool. So I did two pitch meetings yesterday. The I Am 8-Bit one was the last one we did. After that, we went to a dinner as Future Club our agent invited us to a fancy place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice. It was really cool because, like, I got to interact with folks from Future Club in person and not just from a business perspective.
Right.
And so, like, that went really, I felt like that went really well. It was just cool to
hang out. I thought you were going to say I got to interact with, like, King Crab and.
Oh, no. It wasn't that.
Excuse me, boy. Caviar.
They did have some fancy booths, though. I did try a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But it was nice. It was cool. And I met some new people. Cool. One of them had the phone that I have. I have the Galaxy Z Flip phones. Somebody else had it in the exact same color, and I was like, yeah.
You, like, bonded over
here. Yeah. Yep. We're friends now.
It's pretty good.
I went to a talk called Occupational Burnout in Games 2024. Causes, Impacts, and Solutions.
Hey.
Yeah. And, like, it was interesting because, like, burnout is not unique to the games industry.
Right.
So it was interesting. These two people had both been through burnout, and they kind of put out a unscientific survey, which the main takeaways from that survey is, number one, this is like a being have scientific background, I was like, this is a completely biased survey.
Sure.
Because it's who responds. It's a response-based bias.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, they called out and were like, if you experience burnout, you know, so on this survey.
Yeah.
And so only people who experience burnout do, and only people who saw the survey on whatever social media platform they put it out, filled it out. And so, like, they were trying to make, you know, generalizations that, like, it really happens, you know, like, mainly to the first, in the first 0 to 6 years of your career, and is unlikely to happen, you know, and is less likely, but still likely to happen after 20 years.
Hmm.
And I was like, no, that's just old people not filling out your weird survey.
Yeah, they just, like, gotten used to it. And
yeah, like, it's because you didn't, you know, reach out to a group that, you know, had been in the positions for 20 years. And then, like, you know, they were like, of the, you know, the different, like, levels, this is what it is, or this is, like, who it affects. And so, like, basically the takeaway is that it can affect anyone, and it does affect anyone.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to go over, like, it's essentially, like, extreme sustained stress.
Yeah.
So whatever that is, you know, it doesn't have to be extreme as in my life is in danger in that kind of traumatic response, but ongoing. Three of my dimensions of burnout are energy depletion to exhaustion, reduced efficiency, and cynicism/mental distance. And then the other thing they basically said is that one person in your studio is experiencing burnout, there's probably a lot more experience burnout that just don't talk about it because it's not well understood by the people experiencing it. So if they go to their boss and they're like, I'm feeling burnout, they're like, take a week off, you know, like, and, like, you know, that's not necessarily going to help. But then you may also go, what can I do to help you? And the person's like, I don't know.
Right.
Nobody really knows. So, like,
they were JIRA tickets.
Yeah. So I would say that, like, you know, kind of what it felt like to me was a lot of the things that lead to it are kind of a lack of control. It's a lot of working and feeling like you're not making a difference.
Yeah.
Mm.
Or don't have control over the process that you're working within. So, like, working in a system where it feels like nobody appreciates you, or it feels like, you know, I used to have ideas to make the system better, but nobody listens, you know, to me to the point of implementation.
Yeah.
And so I'm stuck being this cog.
Yeah. That's a really interesting lens, because we've talked about on the show about, like, the difference between, like, overwork when it's for yourself versus for someone else, even if it's work that you want to do, right? And it's hard sometimes to know the difference when it's like, I'm passionate, I love every minute of it, but I'm working for someone else. And that's just a pretty clear cut case of overwork or crunch.
Sure.
But when it's something that belongs to you, you have full investment in, whether you're a you know, a small team indie or whether you're the project lead or whatever, like that often just feels different. And sometimes it doesn't have it has a different emotional toll. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that the lens by which it's like the amount of control you have and the feeling of progress, because definitely when you are overworked, but things are moving along, like I've been in that situation where I'm like, okay, I've gotten so little sleep, but this thing is really humming.
Yeah.
And like, that's also not healthy, right? Not saying that, but that is not crunch, right? Like, it doesn't lead to burnout in the same way.
Sure.
And that's always been something that I've known to be true, but it's also a sort of a dangerous topic because you also want to make sure you don't accidentally scoop up proper, burnout causing behaviors with that sort of excuse. Yes. Like, well, if you're in control and you're having a good time, then it's fine.
Yeah.
Because that's not what I want to say. But it's interesting that lens helps narrow it down and explains it a little better to me, I think.
Yeah. And like, that might be a lot of me projecting into this talk.
Okay.
Because like, there'll be little things that are said, and, you know, me not being primarily in the game designer industry, I was like, this is what, you know, like when I felt burned out, I was like, you know, a lot of it has to do with lack of control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They say like, you know, because I would feel like, because I didn't have bigger control, I felt myself being more kind of angry and controlling the little things that I could. Whereas, you know, if I had been given like more control overall, I would probably be a little less, you know, micromanaging when I didn't, you know, when I'm not in a lead position, I'm not in a supervisory position, and so I don't have any actual power. Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, it's best to let people choose how they do things whenever possible, because they're going to do it the best way that works for them.
Yeah. Well, it also explains why people who, they can feel burnout even when they themselves would say, this doesn't seem like a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But they could be burnt out by that. And also why managers and creative leads can often lack the empathy, because to them, they feel like they're working 10 times as much as people who are complaining about burnout and they're not feeling it.
Yeah, I will say, like, I think I experienced some form of burnout a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit after I started working at Future Club. And I have all the control in the world, because ain't nobody else messing with the code. But I think the reason why I felt that way is because sometimes I feel a bit directionless when I'm not giving any guidance or any goals.
Yeah, you had was not the control you needed.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I have perfect control over what the code can be, but I don't know what the code needs to be. And so I don't feel driven to make the code anything. Yeah. So it made it difficult for me to like do things when they would give me a particular task. I would be like, okay, I got to get this thing. And it's not like a hard thing to do, but I just didn't feel the drive to do it, because I don't know. I definitely feel like there's some kinds of there's some aspect of control that maybe has something mm-hmm. to do with burnout, but
and like the thing that, like, you know, is still kind of anecdotal, but I think is actually very, very true from the survey, is that that people who are experiencing burnout kind of see leaving the studio as one of their only options, and a lot of them will leave their studio because I'm burnt out and I had a different job.
Yeah. Okay. Which isn't actually, it may not necessarily solve the problem.
Right.
But also there's got to be better ways to solve that problem.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. Okay. Yeah. So basically, I think there isn't enough research out there yet to really give good takeaways, other than, like, you know, it's more than just, you know, workload. And and if one person is experiencing, or people are probably experiencing it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then my next talk was about Playdate hardware development from the CEO of Panic. It was a funny talk.
It
was a, like, here's the roller coaster ride we went on to develop this thing.
Yeah.
And then he, like, had kind of a mid-life crisis where he was like, if I die, am I, like, do I have a S-tier deathbed?
Okay.
And his answer was, no, I want to do something cool. And then he made a playdate.
What a way to describe a deathbed. S-tier. Tier list of deathbeds.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Anyways.
Yeah. So it was kind of like the ups and downs, manufacturing, then like manufacturing during the pandemic when there's all these like hardware supply issues. Manufacturing is like something as a software developer, they didn't really think like if they needed a patch, like you could push it out really quickly. But with hardware, you know, when you sign off on a particular design, that's it. And then it becomes your fault. And then sometimes things get delayed because you didn't review something closely enough, or you discover, you know, once you get all the stuff, something is a little bit wrong. Yeah, so that was pretty fun.
Cool.
And then I went up and talked to some of the panic people, and they said, yes, you should make a Noble Engine t-shirt.
Okay, you're sort of shortcutting that whole story.
They sat through a talk.
Yeah.
So then I walked up to the front, and then I asked people if they were developers, and they were like, no, but I've been thinking about it, mostly. And then Cable was signing people's playdates. Mm-hmm. And then I met Arissa, who's somebody you have been in contact with. I'm registering to Mark. And I said, hi, do you know Mark LaCroix? And she was like, yeah, he's awesome. And I was like, I'm married to him. I was like, if he made a t-shirt with Noble Engine on it, would you buy it? And she said, yeah, that's really cute. I said, great. I'll tell him.
That's good.
Is that what you were looking for?
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. That's the whole story.
Yeah.
And not just the chapter one and the epilogue.
And then the people next to her were like, that name seems familiar. And they were like, oh, he's working on the blah, blah, blah thing. Yeah.
I'm bugging Dale here for some background on this whole story, but if you would like to know what she's talking about, we have an episode where I talk about my creation of Noble Engine, a game engine for the Playdate SDK, and we'll put the link to that episode in the show notes. And I really enjoyed that bit at the end there where she said, like, yeah, he's the one working on blah, 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 because we can't talk about it yet. So I enjoyed her charming act of discretion there. So anyway, back to it.
End of story.
Yeah, I know some of the panic people for a couple of different reasons. Arissa's great. Arissa's the dev relations person. They're all fun people over there.
Yeah. So Friday.
Friday started out with it was a lighter day.
Yeah.
None of us did a lot.
Yes.
And it's been
nice.
The two of you have been sick.
Yeah, yeah. My thumb has been kind of sore all day. I don't know why that is exactly. I mean, it might just be I was talking to a lot of people. It might just be we were in a crowd of a bunch of folks. Thankfully, it's not COVID. Both me and Dale tested.
Yes.
And they've tested negative. So
my throat has been sore since yesterday afternoon, and my nose started just like running, starting in that Spider-Man fully talk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got out of that and, oh, this is gross. Never mind.
Sounds good. Yeah. But we did have breakfast with August Brown, friend of the show, who's been on the show a couple times, early this morning. And that was really nice.
Yeah.
It was really chill. We talked for like almost 2 hours, it felt like. Something.
It was a while. Yeah. So, listeners, August Sprout has been on the show a couple times.
Yes.
Dale, there's one.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the episode August was on about publisher dev relations. It's one of the ones that, you know, when I'm handing you a flyer, I might recommend you listen to.
Yeah.
Because it is so helpful if you're an indie developer or if you're a solo developer and you might be looking for a publisher in the future, just like a good overview of, you know, how to approach that, especially when you are young or inexperienced or haven't really thought through that process yet, is a really good one.
Yeah.
And August ran into you, Steven, somewhere and just said, hey,
yeah,
breakfast.
Like on Wednesday or
something. And then you asked us, would you want to get breakfast with August? It's like, that's the best idea I've heard all week.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so nice.
And because he didn't have a lot going on today either, we just hung out for, like you said, for like 2 hours just chatting.
Yeah.
And it was really nice.
I left early to go get some cough drops and some nose medicine.
Yeah.
And I came back to the hotel room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, although other than that, me and Dale have been napping all day.
I came back and I was like, oh, okay, I'm just gonna lay down and whatever. And my thing I want to go to is at 3, and I woke up at 3:08.
Yeah.
And I think someone must have, like, you know, stumbled into a witch's curse or something, because I'm fine.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of what normally happens
right.
in these things.
Right.
I don't know how I avoided whatever cold. I mean, I'm going to get it eventually, probably sounds like, but.
Dear listener, he did get it. And it's really laying me out. Although you probably could hear it in my voice and all these punch-ins. It's almost a week later. And, yeah.
We're all still masking
right.
doors
yeah.
Here. Mm-hmm. And so that helps a little bit. But, you know, obviously the two of you are evidence. Like, it's not a perfect system, especially when no one else is wearing a mask, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is also something I may have picked up at home and then generously donated sure. to Steven.
Yep. So nice. The two of you are napping, and I only went to one talk today.
Yeah.
So still pretty light. It was a roundtable on switching to Unreal.
Oh.
So
I was curious about that.
Yeah. So the whole time I'm walking there, I'm thinking, like, okay, this is going to be interesting. It's a topic I'm fascinated by because there's many reasons to switch to Unreal. And I think implicit in that phrase is from Unity.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And aside from the Unity drama, there's a project that I'm sort of percolating in my mind recently that I really think would be suitable to the strengths of Unreal.
Sure.
And so even though I'm not going to be able to, like, prototype or pitch that thing for, like, at least a year, I think.
Yeah.
Because I'm busy.
Yeah.
I would like to know a little bit more now. Anyways, but the whole time I'm walking to this talk, I'm thinking, like, why isn't this a lecture? Why is this a roundtable? I don't quite understand why. I hope it's not just, because I think I've mentioned before, the roundtables are kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, they can be. Yep.
Yeah. I got there, was really, really good. The questions were great. The fantastic mix of experience in the room.
Yeah.
From people who had a lot of experience to people who had, like, just got over that first hump of, like, you know, learning how it works and what's different. And then, of course, everyone was there in the context of switching from something else, implicitly yeah. Unity. And so that they relayed their experience in a way that was relatable to folks also on that journey.
Cool. That's good.
So that was really cool. So a couple of specific things I learned in the talk that I didn't really know, just from, I've toyed with it and I've, you know, like, built a thing or two, but, like, never really a proper project. It's always just been tutorials and playing around.
Yeah.
But one of the things that really fascinated me and also is a bit disappointing is that Unreal is just, at least according to the folks in this room, is not very well suited to Git.
No.
And part of that is because blueprints just do not play nicely with version control.
Oh.
I guess someone in the room said specifically, and they were exaggerating, but basically, as you work in Unreal, even if you're working in C++, quote unquote, everything is binary. So like your whole project ends up being all these compiled binaries or actual binary files, depending on what, you know, the person of the project. And so, like, merge conflicts are something you just can't resolve for anything. And now, again, I'm assuming a lot of this is exaggeration, but just that he's like, this is the thing you won't know until you use it.
Yeah.
So he recommended version control systems that have exclusive lockout. So you check out a file, belongs to you, no one else on the team can use it.
Yeah.
You have a centralized repository that manages the check in and out process.
That's specifically, Git is bad at that.
Yeah, Git is actually a response to that as a philosophy. Git was like, that's a dumb idea. Here's a better way to do it.
Yeah.
And that's why Git is so fantastic at managing projects that are text.
Yeah.
And also why Git is not great at things like Photoshop files.
Right.
Or, you know, any kind of thing that even with tiny tweaks that you know, and that's why Git LFS exists, and there's a whole, you know, I'm trying to make it work for everybody. But there's something like Perforce, which is a Minnesota company, like Subversion, Boo, right? Boo Subversion. Those apparently just play nicer with Unreal, and it kind of makes sense because Unreal comes from an era before Git. Like the early, you know, the first versions that were used by a lot of studios is Unreal 3. Right. So then it was a proprietary engine that got licensed.
Yeah.
It seems like I was sort of getting the impression from a lot of people's experiences that a lot of that era of game development and of engine design persists even with the latest versions.
Yeah.
Which have lots of breaking changes. And I've always thought of Unreal as being more bold with their like major updates. But, you know, there's some core things about it, and this is one of those. And one of the questions I asked was about console porting, because one of the things Unity did for me as a developer in my career is it let me be a console developer. Mm-hmm. Like, there's the whole licensing process with the platform holders. That's a whole separate thing. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it on the show. But once you have access to those tools and those modules for Unity, the process is actually fairly smooth. And I'm very happy with how that process is built and designed. And each of the platform holders do a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Of documentation, examples.
Right.
And then just within Unity itself, you don't have to worry about forking your project for the different targets.
Yeah.
You can if you're crazy or you have enough management to like
to handle all that.
To do all that.
Yeah.
But you can port from a single code base in Unity, and it's fairly good experience. Apparently not so much in Unreal. I do want to do more research into this, but
sure.
The person who answered my question was saying like, oh yeah, you get the extra thing, but you need to then you get code and you have to recompile the engine from source.
Yeah.
Oh. And it's like, oh, that is fascinating because then what does that mean for having a single code base? And like, what do you load up the same project in multiple things?
Yeah.
How do compiler conditionals work? This is all learnings I'm going to be doing or investigating going forward.
Yeah.
But it was interesting how different that process is because Unity and Unreal feel like the competitors, but they just compete in a market.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly different in terms of tooling.
Yeah.
Like Godot is very similar to Unity.
Mm-hmm.
Even though a lot of things about it are different. Mm-hmm. But I think, and this is not news to a lot of people certainly, but I've learned even more so just how different Unreal is.
Sure.
Somebody in the talk said that Unity is a game engine and Unreal is an Unreal engine, meaning that you have a lot less flexibility.
Yeah.
But then somebody else said, no, that's not what it is. It's Unity is a piece of software to make software.
Oh, okay.
And Unreal is a game engine.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you can see how both of them are right.
Yeah.
You know, and part of me, as someone who's built tooling, developer tooling for Unity,
right.
It would be kind of nice to have a system where it's just like all that stuff out of the box.
Yeah.
You know? Because apparently there are just so many game systems that you'd think as a Unity developer, you're like, why isn't there just save data? Why isn't that just a checkbox and then you use the save data API?
Right.
Why isn't there? And it's like, well, I don't know. Just because then you have lots of flexibility and creativity and you can do it in your own way. And the marketplace of ideas can allow for different approaches. And that's great. And then Unreal is just like, well, we just have it. So
yeah,
just do it that way.
That seems good.
And so what that means is you can actually prototype very quickly in Unreal.
Yeah.
And that does not seem intuitive to me.
That I've heard about Unreal.
Yeah, which is crazy because also more than one person was saying that they can't run Unreal on their laptop. Like it's a very heavy piece of software.
Sure. Okay.
Someone was like, this is why they make 32 core Threadrippers.
Oh,
interesting.
Good to know.
Yeah. It actually kind of makes you appreciate what Unity did in the mid-2000s and how different of an approach that was.
Yeah.
And even it has tons of tech debt, how that's still a differentiator in a way that I don't even hear them talk about that much.
Mm-hmm.
So very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And then also I recognized her voice because she asked a question.
Yeah.
But I ran into Monica Fan,
hey!
A friend of the show.
Cool.
She did a game jam with us,
mm-hmm.
Which was really good. We'll put that in the show notes. You can check that out. That was really fun.
Yeah.
Talked to her a bit afterwards. That was nice.
Yeah. That's
good. But the main thing about it was really funny is that last year at GDC, and we talked about it in the earlier recording.
Yeah.
About how the COVID protocols are pretty much gone now.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not great, but the silver lining or a good thing about it, I guess, is that they didn't have the line going like three times around the block.
Right.
Because they didn't manage that system very well when it was in place.
Right.
And so, last year, Monica and I, we just happened to, we would get in line at the same time and we just hung out for 2 hours. And it was really nice.
That's cool.
And she was like, oh, yeah, I got there and there was no line. And I'm like, oh, that would have been nice. And I felt the same way. So it was cool to run into her.
Yeah, that's good.
But that was the end of my day, pretty much. Then I came back here and the two of you were asleep.
Yeah.
On this, you know, in the bunk beds here in the tiny, tiny hotel room, which was very charming, the both of you. But just running into Monica and running into August, I ran into a lot more people this year than I had in previous years.
Yeah.
And people came up to me, which is not something I ever expect.
Mm.
And it still surprises me each time.
Yeah.
But I've, you know, made enough friends and, you know, a couple of listeners. And,
yeah, cool.
But yeah, I don't know that I'll ever get used to even seeing a friend out here. I still feel anonymous because my first couple of years maybe cemented that feeling with me that like, and there's just so many people.
Yeah.
But
there's so many people.
You know, but like even at the IDGA Mixer, we ran into like three people we knew.
Right.
You know, it's nice. Mm. And I kind of wish I could get used to it. because it's because then I would be better at spotting my friends out there because I didn't approach anyone myself. And I'm like, I'm just not doing this right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think people approach it in different ways. Like,
yeah.
I know that Franny, who is very, very extroverted and she's very sociable.
Yeah.
I now know, especially now seeing her at GDC. She sets up a lot of meetings, like coffee dates and stuff with folks, just so that she can interact with people she hasn't interacted with in a while, even if it's like for 5, 10, 15 minutes.
Uh-huh. You
know? So like I think that could be if you are interested in interacting with people who you haven't been able to interact with in a while, that could be an avenue in which you could do it. It's just like set up a meeting with them.
Yeah.
Like one short one, just to catch up.
Yeah, that seems formal. That's very much up my street.
Yeah.
Well, after I was done with my nap,
yes.
I did the thing that I haven't been allowed to do because I've never had a badge before, which is go to the GDC store.
Oh, yeah. What was at the store? I didn't even check it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. They put the GDC 24 logo on everything.
Yeah.
Do you want a bib for your kid? You got it.
Wow.
If you want like two different tank tops, you can have both of them.
They had like sunglasses, like seven different types.
Yep.
They had a flask.
A battery power bank. You got mouse pads. You got t-shirts. You got raglan sleeve shirts. You got a hoodie sweatshirt. You got like the fleece thing that's like sweater knit. Yeah. So many things.
Mm, dang.
Yeah,
and then I was like, I want none of this.
That's why I didn't even bother to go. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
Well, I'm free.
I'm a sucker for a gift shop, so I always wander in every now and again. And the GDC gift shop is split into three sections. There's the bookstore.
I didn't even bother going in that.
Well, they'll ship it to you, so you don't have to put it in your luggage.
Okay.
And then in the middle, there's IM8-Bit runs a little tchotchke shop.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of vinyl records this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure why. And then the other third, and it seemed like it was like 40% of the total thing was GDC branded merch of all different varieties.
Yeah.
Like airport gift shop kind of stuff. It's just so bizarre. They have so many different types of things.
I don't know. I feel like they've always had that kind of stuff.
And they always have so much left over.
Maybe not a bib, but that might be new.
You can also get a onesie or a t-shirt for your kid.
Oh, my gosh. It's a lot. Okay. I guess they got a brand and this is the opportunity for them.
I suppose so.
Yeah, and next year is 25. So, you know. You gotta buy a different one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For years.
The same thing.
Yeah, they'll never sell something that just says GDC on it.
Yeah.
I think because, I mean, not to be too cynical about it. I think to be not cynical about it, I should say.
Oh, okay.
Is that you get it because it commemorates your time at that particular conference.
Yeah.
That said, it's a little unusual that there is literally nothing that doesn't have the 24 on it.
Yeah.
That feels a little bit cynical.
Yeah.
That they couldn't just have a generalized one.
Yeah.
Because it's not different products every year.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Most of the merch is just the white logo stamped on a product.
Yeah.
And then just has the number of the year on it. And
in
a way that feels like they should just have some generic ones, thank you.
Yeah. So gift shop.
Yeah. I mean, you can tell, dear listener, we're running out of topics.
Yeah.
I am really curious to hear from you, Dale. This was, you've been to the show a couple of times with us or with me.
But not in the event space itself.
Yep. You've come to evening events and you've hung out at the gardens and you've been as much a participant as a lot of people. That is how they experience GDC.
Yeah.
So you've definitely been here before.
Yes.
Okay. This is the first year you had a badge and you went to talks and saw the gift shop and the expo floor. I'm really curious about your general impressions of the whole show and how it compares to either what you expected or just your previous experiences.
A little bit of what I expected because I had heard so much about it before. Mm-hmm. And like 1 year, we actually recorded our GDC special from Moscone West.
Mm.
And so you were like, this is what the rooms look like. And they're giant. And there's lots of chairs. And like they were breaking down the chairs and everything at that time. But I knew how big the rooms were. And
then
also from you about standing in line for certain talks that there were a lot of people there.
Yeah.
I was not prepared for how giant that expo floor is.
Sure. Yeah.
And how absolutely uninterested in everything I was. I mean, I walked through there, like they have like closed rooms in there that you can go in, and I didn't even bother. I basically just wanted to see what food vendors were there before I chose to get some garlic noodles.
Sure.
I stopped at two booths, which were both the like video gaming history booths. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting to me, but like, I don't need any tools. I'm a producer of a podcast. Right. You know.
Yeah, you weren't quite the audience for it.
I'm not the audience for it. Yeah. And it was loud and I was not interested. And, yeah.
And I stood in line for your Unreal t-shirt, so you didn't even need to do that.
I know. And then I went and I was like, oh, they got cookies at Unreal. And then I was like, oh, it's in the t-shirt line, which is really long. I was like, forget that.
Yeah. Sorry that I stood in line for you.
When I didn't get a cookie, it's okay. I got some popcorn. There wasn't a line for that.
Sometimes I just see like bowls of jelly beans at the like smaller booths.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, come on, we're not that far out from like isolating. Like, I don't think of just an open bowl of jelly beans is something you should be allowed to do anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess my big surprise is knowing that the level you have to be at to give one of those talks, and which I don't want to be like, it's, you know, like you don't have to be the CEO of Panic to give one of those talks. You just have, you know, like they take your credentials into consideration, I think. But like, you can be really young and still be a speaker.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they did a really good job. Everyone. Cause like, you know, those are big rooms. And that is like, you know, like that's Stage Fright 101 for, you know, somebody who hasn't given a big talk to a big room before.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody was competent and did really well. But also, like, in past years on Twitter, I've seen, like, they were so surprised I had a speaker badge. But, like, that's just because you look young. It's not because you look. And, like, you know, in other professional conferences, like, you know, like, I work in medical devices. It would probably be a lot of doctors and CEOs.
Sure. Yeah.
And just age-wise, you know, like, that's probably why you're not recognized as speaker, not because you're a woman or a minority. It's the youth thing, and that's something that's different about this conference than other conferences.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, it goes towards the a lot of the different tracks are programmed by different people or different experiences, and there's such a diverse range of types of people who can give talks and types of talks that are given.
Yeah.
And I think this is, it's sort of heartening to know that, like, yeah, you've got the 20-year veteran who's up there to do a thing, but kind of mostly what they do is like some postmortem of some, either the classic postmortems, or they talk about like, you know, something that only they would know.
Yeah.
Not necessarily that someone else who knows something similar would also give a talk on. Like, they'd compete evenly with that person for a speaking slot. And you really, yeah, you, as long as you have a unique take and the whoever's programming that track finds some value in it. It also means if you're applying to be a speaker, there's like a weird sort of total unknown sense of imposter syndrome to it. Because you see people who you feel are peers speak year after year, and you're like, I don't understand, why is that? But that it's because the considerations are kind of random in a sense.
Yeah.
But it's heartening also because it's like, well, we're not an industry that just values only tenure.
Yeah.
Right. That new things can be learned and taught from new people.
Yeah.
And as stodgy and as, you know, as critical as I am of GDC as an institution, that is a really interesting thing to think about it.
Yeah.
That, like, it is a place for the whole industry to get together.
So,
you know?
Yeah. And so, like, I guess I was surprised that people didn't realize how different the game development industry is than other industries.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I guess, you know,
we all do sort of sometimes feel like hobbyists who are getting away with something.
Yeah.
In a sense, right? Even when you find yourself with some success. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the end of our time here.
That's our episode.
All right. Well, we're all going to go to dinner now.
Yeah.
And then we'll see you back in Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm.
That's our show. For show notes and links on this portion of our GDC trip, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale, that's you, Dale.
Yep.
Posts about game dev resources and other stuff, right?
Mostly cats.
reply if you choose, or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes and a bunch of other interesting stuff. I know we talk about it, but sometimes I just like to remind listeners here at the end, there's a lot of good stuff up there.
True.
sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. And so, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Stuff like that. So
yeah, we've said it on the show before, but one of the things they're publishing is Robert Boom.
Yeah,
which was worked on by someone in this room.
Hello.
Max is in bed.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's like,
dear listener, Max has been trying to fall asleep this whole episode.
I'm like listening to a podcast
live. All right, well, let's let Max get back to bed, and we should also go to sleep.
Good night.